No, I think it's, maybe you're right.
The 3-5 element is for the, they run them ground as quit. And to the,
you know, there's no cathode in there, then nobody really cares.
Yeah, with that 3 in the front, it sure sounds like it's a triode, Steve. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a bunch of pins that aren't connected. I'm looking at the schematic now.
I'm looking up the 2 about that, you would.
Yeah, with the 3 in front, it sounds like it's a triode. And Rich Intuio tells us that that tube is frequently run in grounded grid triode service. Okay, we've passed the 9 o'clock bewitching hour. Most of humanity in the United States is listening to a presidential debate. Are there any hams left at all on planet Earth listening to the tech net? We've gone down the list of people who signed in. Is anyone else with, has any questions or comments? Give me a call with us and name right now. K2IW in the tech net.
N2MB, just listening.
I heard N2MB. I heard W2 blank blank blank. Extremely low audio. That first station before N2MB. Who were you? Give us that again with a lot more audio. K2RAW.
Whiskey 2
Tango
Echo Charlie Chris.
Whiskey 2 Tango Echo Charlie Chris. Out of curiosity, Chris, are you running a Baofeng modern day radio? They're the only ones that I know of that have the audio that's that low. Back to you, Chris.
Yes, that's correct. I'm here in Brooklyn, though. I'm just putting an antenna on the roof.
Okay, awful glad you put an antenna on the roof there in Brooklyn. We're hearing you very nicely. A little bit, I guess, in the background. Not to worry. But you're going to have to shout into that microphone. And what I did recently is to buy 3 or 4 of the other models of Baofeng radios. And some of the other models have full audio. But the UV5R, almost all of the ones manufactured recently, have very low audio. That new FCC mandate. And it's going to take the FCC a long time to find out they've made a big error with that change. Those radios are not going to work anywhere near as well as they think. And they think by using more narrow audio, they've got more channels, and they're going to squeeze more signals in there. I don't believe this. They really misunderstand the intermodulation distortion problems, if you know what I mean. So, Chris, now that we're hearing you beautifully, and why in the world are you not watching the presidential debate? Or maybe you are with your other ear is on the presidential debate. And you got the chance to ask anything you want, except how to get rich quick. W2, Tango, Echo, Charlie. Get your IW in the tech net.
No, I'm not watching the debate. I'm at work right now, so I don't have a lot of time. But I wanted to ask Eric a question on Friday night to Saturday. I had a lot of trouble receiving TV over the air. I live in Franklin Square. I use the antenna on the roof to get all my broadcast TV. But apparently a lot of channels dropped out. This went on during the night up until about midnight and again early on Saturday morning. But on Sunday, everything is working fine. So I wonder if they changed the transmission line or the transmitting from the Empire State Building to the New World Trade Center. That's awesome.
That's a good-sounding guess, Chris, but absolutely not. I watch purely over-the-air television, and Friday night, a whole lot of my over-the-air television channels disappeared out here in Huntington. Digital television, the good news is that if you get a picture at all, it's a snow-free picture. The bad news is that the digital television scheme is very vulnerable to co-channel interference. Friday night, we had a big, beautiful band opening. So you were hearing television channels from Maryland, Delaware, Philadelphia, New Jersey, all kinds of places. And whenever there is another channel sitting on top of the New York City channel you want to hear. And if that other channel is not, let me pick a number, 20 decibels weaker, if it comes through with any reasonable strength at all, the digital demodulator in your television set gives up and says, I can't figure out what the hell's going on. That's my impression of what I think is happening. So whenever we have a band opening over the digital television, it's going to be very troublesome. Let me drop. What some of the smart people are doing, even though they know they're in the beautiful range of the Empire State Building, and they don't need an antenna rotator, if you've got your television aerial on an antenna rotator, and you carefully rotate the antenna during co-channel interference, during a band opening, you almost always can get the offending signal to fall into one of the notches of the television aerial antenna pattern, and the problem goes away. So the smarter people who watch over-the-air digital television are making sure they've got a rotator on the antenna, and now they've got the best of all worlds. And they can also aim it toward Connecticut and watch those channels, aim it toward Maryland and watch those channels, as well as living with co-channel interference. Let's see if Eric has got some further information on this. Eric, my impression is when co-channel interference is present, I think the co-channel signal has got to be a whole lot of dB weaker in order not to disturb most of the demodulators that we own today. I'll bet you're going to tell me some of the modern demodulators are going to be less vulnerable. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2EJ. Well, let me tell you, during the band opening, people are really right close to Empire, actually on the Queens side, wound up picking up the station in Philadelphia instead of 13. They were on VHF, so. The ability, if you have a rotator, to find the stronger of the two signals, and you can literally lock onto it, but you know, if you're using a fixed antenna, you're using a set of rabbit ears and stuff like that, you know, you could actually try and manipulate them so as that you're getting the main signal and not the co-channel signal. But a lot of times the co-channel signal just seems to overtake the demodulator faster than the actual signal you're interested in. So, you know, we get a lot of phone calls from we get Trapo, which we hear about an awful lot.
So if I understand you correctly, Eric, because of the band opening we had on Friday night, that's when you at your broadcast center were getting a number of phone calls. And has Mr. Spagnoli or anyone else came up with a number of decibels? In other words, if the co-channel signal is not, let me pick a number, 15 decibels weaker, you might have trouble demodulating the main channel you want to listen to. Is that approximately the number, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
No, there's a guy by the name of Mr. Burns, there's another one. They publish the test. They do a lot of this stuff in the laboratory, which is not exactly the real world. I don't at the top of my head at the moment have the actual number, but I've got it filed away if you really want to know. It's under varying different types of conditions. Simulation is real band opening, but you know, there ain't nothing like sticking your antenna up there and finding out what's actually going on when it happens.
Now, one of our frequent contributors is Joe, W2RYY, who has done an awful lot of spectrum analyzer viewing, simultaneous television reception over the air. Joe, have you come up with a rough number of how much weaker the undesired signal must be so that your digital television demodulator will be happy? I wonder if any of your experiments give you an approximate vulnerability number. How many dB weaker must the bad guy be before it gives you no grief? To K2LYY, if you're still there, Joe, K2LYW, the tech man. Yeah, maybe Joe has gone away.
I don't know how much weaker it is, because we don't go off the air.
He's watching all of these signals on his spectrum analyzer, so he can recognize the slight offset of the carrier, what he calls the carrier.
No offset.
the difference on his spectrum analyzer of the main channel and the extraneous signal. On a number of occasions, he can see that extraneous signal on his spectrum analyzer, is what he claims, Eric. One other question I've got for you, Eric. Obvious by the number of phone calls you got, amazing to me, there's a fair number of people in, say, Queens who are watching over-the-air television but not using a cable service of some kind. What's your guess as to how big is your over-the-air listening audience? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2LAW, KE2EJ. Well, you got to remember, I work for PBS, and we're different than the commercial stations. We're the baby theater and so on and so forth. So we could actually, we have higher percentage numbers of people that are actually watching us over the air than the commercial guys get. And when the World Trade Center went down, that's when we discovered that we were nearing 40% of our viewers were on antennas. I don't know what it is today. I've been away from the main office, so I don't get to see all that stuff anymore, but I can add.
Okay, so over those years since the World Trade Center went down, it's been modified a little bit, but at that time, roughly 40% of the PBS watching audience was doing it over the air at that time. That's an amazing number to me. I expected you to tell me 3 or 5%. 40%. And even if it's going down to 25% today, of the people, of the smart people watching PBS, some significant percentage are doing it over the air. I mean, I live in what I think is an affluent community. There are 25,000 people in the little place called Dix Hills, Long Island. 25 square miles, 26,000 people. I can go up and down all of these streets and look for an over-the-air television aerial. It would have to be on the chimney of the house because we've got tall trees and we're 30-some-odd miles away from New York City. I can only find one single human being who's got an over-the-air television aerial of those 25,000 people in this community. But you're saying closer to Queens, that may be almost 40%. Wow. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
You need to learn about demographics a little bit more. All of Long Island has what, 2.5 million people? All of New York City, Manhattan, Queens, Staten Island, the Bronx, and Brooklyn have about, it's approaching 9 million people. So even receiving TV over antennas is not such a hard thing to do, you know, rapidly in and around nearby New York, the transmission facilities. And you would have to equate the areas, the demographics of the areas that do the major reception. You would have to compare them to, like, you know, being on Long Island, you'd have to compare them to Hempstead or Wynedance, those particular areas that are somewhat economically depressed, to even imagine a parallel in terms of viewership in relation to what goes on in New York City.
Of the hills and valleys and tall trees, I mean, almost all the oak trees in my community are more than 60 feet tall. And except for my carefully chosen piece of land, which was house number 51 that I found that particular year, is the one I'm living in, and I'm 300 feet above sea level. Almost all of my community, the people who are living in the valleys, behind trees, and they're not getting over-the-air television if they try.
What's the median income of the people that you're talking about?
Of the people I'm talking about, the people in my community, I think you're asking what is their median income, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I'm sure that there's a website will tell me, but I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find the median household income is $130,000. Go ahead.
Okay, what do you think the median income of the projects in the Lower East Side, or the areas in Brooklyn that you can still afford to live, or those places in Queens and the Bronx? You're lucky if you've got people that are making families that have got $50,000 a year. And do you think they're going to spend $3,000 a year for cable?
I hear you. If I bought the bare bones minimum cable service, would I still be paying $3,000 a year, Eric Gagahead?
Well, I don't know what it is in your neighborhood, but, you know, bare bones cable from, like, Time Warner and those people, you're looking at, like, $50 a month in that neighborhood, maybe a little bit less, a little bit more. $50 to a family with an income of $50,000 or less is an awful lot of money, isn't it? And then multiply that by 12.
That would be $600 a year. That's a hell of a lot cheaper than the $3,000 you told me about. The $3,000 guy, he's a guy who has bought all of the pay-per-view services. Isn't that true, Eric?
Well, you got to consider something that's not true 10 years ago, and that is you're generally getting, not only are you getting your TV, but you're getting your telephone and your internet, and that's where you're getting the $2,000 or $3,000 a year, you know. If it's $200 a month for cable, telephone, and, you know, HBO and this and that, if you're buying cable, I don't see too many people buying basic cable and nothing else. They, you know, they'd be getting telephone and internet and so on and so forth. The people in the city just don't do that. A lot of them are still on copper.
Okay, so the five boroughs of New York City, something in the vicinity of 8 or almost 9 million people. Of that particular crew, I think you're saying of those who frequently watch PBS, maybe almost 40% of those people are watching.
Well, trade center went down. We were very surprised that the numbers came up that high. By the way, it's not just New York City, it's also on the other side of the Hudson River.
And when that band opening occurred last Friday night, I think you're saying even those people in the five boroughs, so close to the Empire State Building, they still were sometimes getting a stronger signal from the band opening than they were from their local Empire State Building. Is that true?
Correct. I think we got something like 400 or 500 phone calls.
Once again, 400 or 500 phone calls, is that what you said?
That's what I said.
Wow. Roughly when did that start, and roughly when did it end? Was it all day Friday, so to speak?
I don't know what the duration was. I just had to deal with the emails and people asking me why this is happening. So, once I gave them the answer, that was the end of my connection to it. So.
Now, how big is the staff at PBS that can answer 500 phone calls, or were many of those communications email? Were those really phone calls, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, it was both phone calls and email. And we also got a few phone calls from a couple of cable companies, because I'm 40 or 50 miles away.
And so they were calling you to make sure that you hadn't made some kind of a change to the service, just like we were just asked earlier tonight. And obviously you guys didn't make any change. Mother Nature made the change. And sporadic E is what it could be. Super refraction is what it would be. Super refraction is where you get a moist layer of air down low and dry air up top. It causes a downward bending of the wave, and it can follow Earth's curvature and get really, really far. I was seeing dew on my automobile Friday night, so I knew we were getting a band opening. So that's super refraction, and probably it wasn't sporadic heat, but both of those conditions are not dependent on the sunspot cycle. That can happen almost any time of the year other than the dead of winter. We don't get band openings in the dead of winter with rare exceptions. Isn't that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, it does happen once in a blue moon. There's actually a site that most of the broadcasters use called Tropo. I can't think of it right now, but it's basically stage weather. You know, it's how
around you. How much, they call it tropo activity, rather than being, you know, being healer or whatever, what have you. I can't think of the name of the site right now, but next time they ask me, I'll probably remember.
The guy's on 10 gigahertz. Know of a website that will give you a map of the United States and maybe a little bit of Canada and Atlantic Ocean and the Caribbean area. And by various colors and sections of that map, it tells you how much long-range radio propagation you're getting at microwave frequencies. So there are a number of websites that will give you propagation information. And I'll see if I can find the ones that are used by the guys on 10 gigs. And you know of one that's frequently used by people who are doing over-the-air DXing with television broadcasting, Eric?
For FM and TV broadcasts, that covers from low VHF all the way up to the top of the UHF.
Yeah, the so-called Worldwide FM TV DX Association, Worldwide Broadcast TV and FM DX Association, that's a great big abbreviation. They used to publish this beautiful spiral ring notebook that they updated every couple of years, in which they gave you lots of information along these lines. They also told you, they gave you a map of the United States, and as you flipped each page, you would see all the Channel 2s, all the Channel 4s, and so on, of broadcast television. And with their call letters, height above average terrain, broadcast transmit power, network of affiliation, all of that jazz. I don't know if they're still in business, but if they were, I think they would have a website. K2EJ for anything more? K2LAW?
K2IW, K2J. There's a commercial organization that publishes the book. That's all that information. I can't think of anything. TV Digest, that's what it is. I don't think they have a propagation website. But then again, I don't know what's out there with it. But I kind of like, don't have to deal with it. There's other people that deal with it all the time. So I can look it up and see what's out there. I'm sure there's more stuff, but I generally go to SpaceWeather. SpaceWeather.com is a good place. Anyway, I'm going to pop out of here for a second, but I'll be right back. P2RWK.
Okay, thank you, Eric. And I'm very glad you're in the command setup tonight, if you know what I mean. Alrighty, I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in with a question or a comment. And I think it's time we go over to John, KC2WGB. How many communications have you received this week, John? And I'm glad you're back. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, and it's good to be back. And good evening, Dick, everyone on the net. And been a slow week. It's between them going back and forth to school and getting resettled. Things have slowed up a little bit, but I have a couple of questions. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on to my first one. Okay, this young shortwave listener has a question about noise. He wants to know why almost anything can interfere with intelligent transmission, but yet noise is so difficult to handle. Why is that? Maybe you can give him some tips on that, Dave. KC2WGB, back to you.
Yeah, try a little bit of rewording because I'm not absolutely sure I understand what the question is, John. And maybe add a few of your words as to what you believe the questioner is asking for. Is he asking for the noise that exists of amplifiers of any reasonable radio? Is he asking for atmospheric noise? Is he asking about man-made noise if you live in the metro area? What do you believe he's really asking? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good point, Dick. Basically, it's the shortwave listening. He notices noise areas and his station signals, and the station signals seem to be affected in a very critical way to where it's something you can't really hear anymore. almost anything interferes with it. Where when he looks at noise, it's very difficult to get rid of it, and it seems to be ubiquitous sometimes. And to catch a signal in between and try to just get that intelligent signal is difficult at times. But noise seems to be everywhere. And he'd like to know maybe if you have an explanation for why it's so pervasive. Does that help?
A little bit. And I'm going to give at least two separate answers here. For a shortwave listener, and many shortwave listeners are listening at the frequencies between 4 and 7 megacycles, between 7.3 and 14 megacycles. They're listening to all of those frequencies in between the ham bands. And many shortwave listeners like to listen to international broadcasts on HF frequencies. And one of the things that frequently happens is you're listening to a HF frequency, particularly if it's an amplitude modulated broadcast. And most of those foreign broadcast stations are using amplitude modulation. There's a real carrier there. And you very frequently get multipath propagation, which gives you selective fading. By that I mean, you may be getting the signal from, let me pick a number, London, and one of those signals you're getting from London is bouncing off the ionosphere and bouncing off the Atlantic Ocean and getting to you after three bounces, and you might simultaneously be hearing that signal getting to you by way of four bounces at slightly different angles. So these two different signals are coming to your receiver by slightly different paths, and there's a whole lot of ways they can come to you by different paths, reflecting off the ionosphere, reflecting off clouds, reflecting off aurora clouds and things like this. Anyhow, whenever you get two separate paths, there is a statistical probability that the carrier of path number one and the carrier of path number two will fall 180 degrees out of phase, and the carrier gets nulled out. It's called selective fading. You're still hearing the upper and lower sidebands because they're on a slightly different frequency, they got slightly different phase shift, and they're not being canceled. Let me drop. But during the time the carrier gets canceled, because your receiver is not re-injecting a carrier, and the carrier is there to beat against the sidebands to give you the detected audio, during the time you're getting that selective fade, the signal you hear sounds like Donald Duck. It sounds like single sideband broadcast where you didn't turn on the beat frequency oscillator back in the old days when we used to listen to single sideband without a product detector. So that's one thing that you get with HF broadcast, shortwave listening. Let me drop. Another thing you get is that the ionosphere itself is very noisy. Man-made noise, you may have a parking lot that's near you with a whole bunch of fluorescent lighting. They make a whole lot of man-made noise. The man-made noise, frequently you can tell by looking at it with an oscilloscope or knowing what you're listening to. You'll hear a 60-cycle or 120-cycle primary component, which is the power line frequency around here. But the ionosphere itself is reflecting signals from all over the world, and there's probably 1,000 thunderstorms going on somewhere on planet Earth right now. And all of those thunderstorm crashes of all of that lightning, all of that's getting to you. The bottom line is you connect and disconnect an antenna to a shortwave receiver and watch what the signal strength meter does and listen to what the loudspeaker is doing. Let me drop it. And you'll hear a lot of difference in noise, particularly if you tune in between stations. There's a lot of noise there. Between the antenna connection of any reasonable radio receiver and the loudspeaker, there's approximately 120 decibels of gain. So very, very weak signals in microvolts coming into your antenna constitute a pretty strong signal as far as the high gain receiver is concerned. So you're getting atmospheric noise, you're getting ionospheric noise, you're getting galactic noise, you're getting man-made noise, and you're getting selective fading of those HF signals because of multipath. You put it all together, and It takes a little bit of practice to know what the heck you're listening to when you're listening to a shortwave broadcast. I bet you you've seen that that selective fading, where it sounds like Donald Duck, and that selective fade will sometimes slowly drift across the frequency region you're listening to. During the time it's nulling out the carrier, you hear Donald Duck. During the time it's nulling out the upper sideband or the lower sideband, you'll hear certain portions of the audio spectrum get suppressed. You may hear a 600 hertz note, or the 600 hertz region of human speech gets suppressed, and the voice sounds a little bit peculiar because of the selective fading, slowly drifting around as you're listening to a shortwave broadcast. KCQ-WGB, KQLIW, that's some of the answer.
KC2WGB. Oh yeah, very good. Yes, I've heard that fading, and sometimes it becomes a very rhythmic type. It's almost like waves coming and going. It all depends on what's causing it, whether it's the atmosphere and the motion of the atmosphere. A lot there. I don't know how new this gentleman is to this young guy is to shortwave listening, but it's been hell for some people, but he was just inquiring and wanted to know why it's so much difficult, so much more difficult to be able to get rid of noise when you can get rid of the intelligent information very simply. But I thought it was a good question. All right, let me let it drop and I'll go on to the next one.
Before you do, there's a couple of things you can do about this. You can put up an antenna that favors east-west, you can put up an antenna that favors north-south. And you flip back and forth between those two antennas, your particular shortwave broadcast signal today is going to sound better on one antenna than the other. Second of all, if the over-the-air shortwave broadcast signal you're listening to, shortwave, happens to be amplitude modulated, and I think most of them are, if you do single sideband reception on that signal, which means you flip your receiver to the single sideband mode, which means it is re-injecting the carrier. You carefully tune to make the tone of the zero beat, so to speak. Can we drop this? When your receiver is re-injecting the carrier that is being nulled out by selective fading, you will not hear the Donald Duck sound anymore. That goes away. And you'll hear some pretty good sounding audio. And while you're listening in the single sideband mode, you have the other option. You can decide to listen to the upper sideband or the lower sideband. They both have the exact same information, but depending on the state of the ionosphere and other extraneous signals, one of those sidebands is going to sound better than the other. So by using single sideband reception, and many of our single sideband receivers, I'll admit they've got more restricted audio, and therefore, in some respects, the high fidelity and the low frequency notes might not sound the same. But there's ways you can modify your single sideband receiver to correct for that. But in the single sideband mode, where you're re-injecting the carrier and you're selecting upper sideband or lower sideband, you'll make significant improvement in intelligibility if that's what you're looking for. And by the way, single sideband doesn't have to sound like restricted audio. It can have complete high fidelity. Back in the old days, let me drop this. Back in the old days, when Bob Bell's telephone system was primarily communicated by way of 2.3 gigahertz microwave repeater stations across the United States, all of those multiple telephone signals were all master group, super group, and whatever. There was a main pilot tone in there, and every one of those individual channels was single sideband. You may not know it, but all those television, all those telephone audio signals you heard in, say, 1950, 1960, they were a single sideband repeated signal throughout all those repeater stations across the United States. So with the right kind of hardware, single sideband can give you very high fidelity. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Wow, Wow, that's a great recommendation. If his, if he has that feature to be able to go to single sideband on his, he didn't tell me what model or what brand shortwave radio he has, but wow, yeah, that can make a big difference. Good information. I'm sure he'll appreciate that. All right, let me let it drop. We'll go on to the next one. Okay, I have a gentleman here with some information on RFID tags. He would like to know what causes degradation on RFID tags and what is the cause of failure. Can they receive too much signal and damage them? Do they have a consumable products? Do many failures happen with them? Things like that. And are they degraded by ultraviolet light? So maybe you could help them out with that. Degradation on RFID tags. Back to you, Dave.
For a 10-year period of time, on a daily basis, I was working with RFID tags, RFID interrogators, RFID readers. Arguably the best manufacturer of the little mini integrated circuit chip that does all the work inside of an RFID tag. Arguably one of the best manufacturers is the Avery Dennison Company. Avery Dennison makes some very sensitive RFID chips. And when you connect that to a printed circuit antenna that is really a dipole, roughly 915 megacycles is its center frequency, 902 to 928, you connect that to this dipole, which is in many embodiments 4 inches long, 4.5 inches long in that order. But there's a zillion different ways you can make the dipole more compact and so on. And some of them are compacted to the point where you can put them inside of a soda cap. But most of them are full range. But you take a Avery Dennison manufactured chip on a well-made RFID tag, Alien Company among others. Motorola for a while was building them. And you put that tag in a reasonably free environment. In other words, you're not slapping it up against a soda bottle where water at those frequencies, the 915 megacycles, the water that's in soda is extremely absorptive and dissipative. It'll drastically cut down the range. But you take that tag with a state-of-the-art reader. You can read that tag at approximately 22 feet. The tag is 22 feet away from you, being held up, in other words, you taped it to a piece of paper. The piece of paper is held with a clothesline, a clothespin on a clothesline, so the tag is really in free air. And you stand 22 feet away from it with a good reader. You'll read the 96 bits of information that's on that tag. It's serial number and all the other information that can be put on that. 96 bits of information on a typical tag. And there are special tags where you can rewrite the information with your reader, and you can put a lot more than 96 bits on there. Now, what's going to cut down the range? Let me drop. Depending on what kind of floor you're standing on, that floor can be very reflective. So the poor tag out there is seeing a direct signal from your reader that's in your hand, a handheld reader, and it's seeing a reflection off the floor. And so at the magic range for the average height of a tag, at roughly 16 feet, the reflection off the floor and the direct signal fall 180 degrees out of phase, and you see a great big gap. So if somebody is holding the piece of paper that's got the tag on it, and he slowly walks away from you, you're reading him beautifully all the way up to 16 feet, maybe 13 feet, 14 feet, then there's a gap between 13 and 17 feet in which you're not reading the tag. As he continues to walk, up to 22 feet, you're reading the tag. You ask the guy to go back to that dropout region of 16 feet, and you ask him to hold the tag higher up or lower down, now the reflection off the floor is a little bit more in phase or out of phase, and the tag will start reading again. So multipath is one of the things that interrupts tag. Putting it against lossy materials. You slap that tag against a metal oil can, for instance, and you'll have trouble reading it at 3 feet. slap it against a soda bottle. You have trouble reading it at more than 5 feet and so on. You can still read it. You can put the tag literally in a glass of water. And as long as you're holding your reader 2.5 feet away, you'll meet the tag. When you bring the tag super close to a reader and the reader runs 1 watt of power output, and you slap the tag right on the antenna of this 1 watt of output, and you think you're going to burn out the tag, the tag has got a built-in limiter circuit. So at the 1 watt level, with reasonable spacing, you're laying it on the antenna itself of the reader, you're not going to burn it out. Now, another thing that can affect the tag range, let me drop it. As a cell phone, your tag might be hanging on a sweater that's on the rack, and so the manufacturer has put these RFID tags on all the sweaters so that periodically they send a staff member around to read all the tags to do inventory to know whether or not the size 32 sweater is on the rack by reading all these tags. And by the way, the tags can also be on a bunch of cardboard boxes that are on a pallet, and the pallet is being moved by a forklift truck out of at the dock of a warehouse. And so you could read as many as 500 tags per second as they're whipping through the dock that's got the right kind of reading antennas on this forklift, as the forklift is taking this load off the truck, going through the dock bay doors, and about to put those tags on a shelf somewhere. The possibility exists you can read 500 tags per second, even though they're all on a whole bunch of boxes, just as long as the tags are not laying directly on top of each other. When the tags lay directly on top of each other, the antennas do interfere, and your range gets cut down. So lossy materials, tags, the tags can also be the wrong polarity. Let me drop it. If your particular reader has a pure linear polarized antenna that's horizontally polarized, and the tag is sitting on the sweater, and the tag is vertically polarized, that will drastically cut down your range. And if you, the holder of the reader, will rotate your hand 90 degrees, you'll pick up a hell of a lot of those tags that you think are not there. You could buy a reader that's got circular polarization, and you think you're now going to read tags from all directions. To a degree, that's true, but there's a problem. A circular polarized reader is putting out half of its energy horizontal, half of its energy vertical, so instead of having 22 feet of range, you're going to have 16 feet of range because you're using a circular polarized antenna. Maybe you're going to have 12 feet of range because you lose half the power on transmit. The tag is almost always a linear polarized device. Let me drop it. So even though your reader is transmitting a circular polarized signal, the tag only receives half of that energy because it's either horizontal or vertical or slant 45, but it's only receiving half the energy of the circular polarized transmission. The tag is now reflecting energy back and talking to you, giving you the 96 bits of information. It's a linear retransmitted signal going back to a circular polarized antenna. You lose another 3 dB. You lose 3 dB on transmit, you lose 3 dB on receive if you're using a circular polarized reader. If you're using a linear polarized reader, and if the skilled operator using that reader is willing to rotate his hand 90 degrees while he's doing the reading, he's going to get maximum range and pick up all tags. So there's lots of variables involved. You can buy a specialized tag that's made to go against a metallic object. It's got a built-in spacer. So the spacer in there might be a quarter of an inch thick. So the tag itself is held a quarter of an inch away from the metallic object you're putting it on, and the tag has been retuned to operate correctly in that environment. Let me drop. Now, let's assume you've got a rack full of clothing, and you're reading all these tags, and you're as much as, let me pick a number, 15 feet away from the rack, and you're waving your interrogator around, picking up all those tags, and somebody comes along with his cell phone, and his cell phone happens to be on, we'll say, 900 megacycles. The actual dipole on the tag is a fairly broadband device. The person standing there with the cell phone, and if he's talking to a cell site that's far away, so the cell phone is running at maximum power, the tag is literally being jammed. Even though the cell phone is on of the frequency. The tag is picking up the cell phone frequency that dominates the detector, the rectifier that's in the tag. See, what the tag does is it takes the RF energy coming out of your interrogator. Let me drop. It rectifies that energy. That energy goes into a capacitor. The capacitor becomes the voltage that runs the integrated circuit chip. The integrated circuit chip is now making short circuits and open circuits alternately on the antenna. That's how it's making the digital signal by way it transmits back to you. So it's a thoroughly passive device. Never, doesn't need any battery of any kind, can work for many years. They can tolerate pretty high temperature, pretty low temperature, ultraviolet radiation, pretty strong amounts of RF energy. The amount of RF energy that can damage a tag is getting close to the threshold that would be of consideration for radio frequency biohazard for a human being. You take the maximum RF energy you can expose a human being to, the tag can take that and then some. So you'd have to do something pretty drastic to take a properly operated, properly designed tag and destroy it. That's some of the information. There's a lot more to it. I've now talked to you about purely passive tags. There are semi-passive tags that have a battery inside, which helps it in the receiver mode, and they can have a range of 300 feet. There are tags, the easy pass that you put on the windshield of your car, that is a semi-passive tag. Let me drop it. They operate at either 900 or 2.3 gigahertz, and there's a battery built inside. And that easy pass tag is an RFID tag. Because of the battery, it's got a hell of a lot more range. But the battery goes dead in about 5 years, so the easy pass tag has to be repeated, has to be replenished in about 5 years. But there's a lot of technology going into these RFID tags. That's some of the information. You probably have some additional questions on what you've heard, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. No, you covered that pretty well, Dick. Wow, a lot of information, and such a small device with hardly any components in it. And look at all of the things it can do. And the amount of information from these new tags is just unbelievable. But, no, well answered, I believe. All right, let me let it drop.
Yeah, I'm going to give you one other piece of information. The little black dot, that's the actual integrated circuit that's in the center of that dipole. You almost can't see it without a microscope or a magnifying glass. I'm not sure exactly, but I'm going to guess it's in the vicinity of a 10,000th of an inch square, maybe a 5,000th of an inch thick. It's a tiny little device, and that will speak to you. That does all that rectifying, communicating, 96 bits of information. It's got a built-in random generator. In other words, when you're reading those 500 tags at once, each one of those individual tags is rolling a random number generator, deciding when it's going to talk back to your particular interrogator so that they don't talk on top of each other. All of that crazy circuitry is built into there. And you can be using it to do telemetry operations. You could locate one of those tags literally on the wire of a high voltage transmission line. And it could be reading the current. By reading the mail, not a magnetic field, it could be reading the current. And so you walk by with your interrogator, stand underneath that high voltage line, and find out how much current is flowing through that particular wire right now. You could put that RFID tag inside of a room, and it'll tell you the temperature, the humidity, or whatever, a specialized tag. So you can put them in all kinds of crazy places, and it can read all kinds of information to you. How much sunlight is hitting the tag, how much humidity, how much temperature. And the tag itself, in some cases, can be recording this information, and you can read it back at a later time. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, you know, you also wonder, what other future elements are they going to use it for? There are so many ways of monitoring things. Appliances could be monitored that way and get a history out of them if it's something that can be recorded. And predicts failures on structure equipment. Wow. A lot of good stuff there. And they're relatively cheap. And you said they want to get it cheap enough. I think you said they're like 25 or 30 cents now, and they want to get it to a nickel, I believe. Is that the price they want to head for, Dick?
Just about exactly right, John. They're in that 25 to 30 cent category today, and they're looking forward to the day when it will be assembled by a more automatic process, and they're looking forward to the day when they will get down to 5 cents per tag. You're not going to put a tag on each individual stick of Wrigley's gum, if you know what I mean. So they're only used for things above a certain value. But and the Internet of Things is going to be a mixture of RFID tags and other kinds of Internet communication with all the appliances in your house. It's just a matter of time. Over to you, John. K2LIW.
Yeah, there's a big future in that because I believe that manufacturers are going to want to monitor the actual operation of the devices that they sell us to see if we're using them right, to see if they're performing right. So as they tweak those applications, wow, that could be a lot of information, you know, for manufacturers to improve their quality of their instrumentation and their products. Great stuff. All right, let me let it drop. I'm on the next.
And by the way, the tag itself can easily have a lifetime of at least 10 years, if not beyond. Who do you return?
Yeah, for a passive device that's so inexpensive, to have a longevity of 10 years, that's incredible too. Well, that's today's market. Okay, this question comes from a young gentleman who's interested in copper line telephones. There are inductive loop couplers that can be placed next to a telephone line, and you can monitor everything on there. His question is there a way to detect a loop coupler being placed on a line like that? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
In the old days, maybe. Nowadays, I think the answer is no. If you wanted me to design a circuit by which I could pick up the signal that's on a twisted pair telephone line in such a way that I'm using a very sensitive field effect transistor where I can sense the capacitive coupling of nanovolts or microvolts and nanovolts coming off that line, could you detect that my circuit is lying adjacent to your twisted pair? Not a chance. So you allow a smart guy to design a circuit that can monitor that line. He doesn't have to make direct connection to it, and he doesn't even have to loop the wire through his circuitry. You can see, you remember these things that you can buy which allows you to detect the bad light bulb on a series string of Christmas tree light bulbs. They're looking for the 60-cycle, 120-volt waveform that's coming off that piece of wire by capacitive coupling, and some of those detectors can be a couple of inches away from the wire and still detect the fact that there's voltage there. You take some of that kind of circuitry, a slightly more sensitive version of it, and you allow me to put it, let me pick a number, a 16th of an inch away from your twisted pair. I can listen to all of those signals that are on that twisted pair, and there's no easy way that you can detect the fact that I've modified your piece of wire in that way. I haven't cut into the wire. I don't have to make direct contact. I can be 16th of an inch, 8th of an inch, maybe even a quarter of an inch away, and still pick up all those signals. So I didn't say that that's an easy thing you can go out and buy. All I'm telling you, the technology exists to do that. KC2WGB, K2IW, the tech man.
KC2WGB, yes, deceptive, very intriguing, and I believe you're absolutely right. You're not disturbing, you're not loading, So to detect that would be extremely difficult. It might be doable in some ways, but there are so many points of access for that signal along that line where it's either it's going to be less shielded or maybe a little higher current path, and I think it's very doable. So, yeah, I agree. Okay, we'll move on to the next one, the last one. Okay, I have a youngster here who is in love with science fiction movies like Frankenstein, and he loves these machines that they run in the background, you know, the Tesla coils and all the spark machines. But he has a question about the Jacob's ladder. He wonders why does the spark rise, starts at the bottom of that little V and travels up to the top and then breaks and starts again. Why does that happen? Maybe you could help him out with that, Dick. KC2WGB.
If that V of a Jacob's ladder was held horizontally instead of vertically, the spark would sit at the narrow gap beginning bottom of the V and never travel. When you set the V up vertically, the current flowing through that spark is creating local heating. The local heating of the air creates a convective upflowing air flow. The air moving up, because it's heated, pushes the spark, and therefore it keeps going up to higher and higher altitudes. Eventually it gets to the point where the voltage that you've applied is not high enough to sustain the spark. The spark is broken, and it reforms back at the bottom and repeats the process. So it rises because of heating. If you try to operate that Jacob's ladder inside of a vacuum bell jar, you would get absolutely no spark, because it's the air breaking down that gives you the spark. It's the heating of the air gives you the rising of the spark. If you did operate that inside of a vacuum gel, a vacuum bell jar, let me drop it, and you very slowly evacuated the air, as you go down to lower and lower air pressures, you see some very interesting characteristics, where the spark would change color, change intensity. The spark would go higher up the ladder, because as you go down to, I don't know the exact number, somewhere around 60 or 80,000 foot of altitude, that amount of air pressure, air breaks down much more easily. If you did the opposite, if you operated the bell jar with air compressed as opposed to vacuumed, if you put high enough pressure air inside the vacuum bell jar, the spark would disappear. Ain't that crazy? Air at very high pressure is an extremely good insulator. Air at a rather low pressure is a very poor insulator. It'll arc over. Air in a perfect vacuum is once again a very high insulator. It can tolerate a very high voltage without arcing over. The crazy curve of breakdown voltage of air versus air pressure is called the Paschen curve. P-A-S-C-H-E-N, I think is the man's name who studied this. But if you're getting breakdown of your coaxial cable because you're running kilowatts of power through it, air filled Andrew Heliac, so to speak, you're getting air breakdown in your Andrew air-filled Heliac coaxial cable, 7/8 inch, inch and a quarter, inch and 5/8. You've got a couple of choices. You can fill it with dry nitrogen, which gives a slightly higher breakdown voltage. You can fill it with sulfur hexafluoride, which gives you 2 or 3 times the voltage of breakdown. Or you can just fill it with dry air under high pressure. High pressure air has a higher breakdown voltage. Under normal atmospheric conditions, air is good for 30,000 volts per centimeter. You put two rounded objects 1 centimeter apart in normal air. Until you get to roughly 30,000 volts, you won't get an arc over. There's something I was going to say with that one. What was that? I forgot what I was going to say with that one. Oh, yes. And now you put those two two same objects with 1 centimeter of spacing inside of the opposite of a vacuum belt.